Welcome to another edition of Voices from the Red Hills, a forum produced by Heart of the Earth, where we talk with people making a difference in our bioregion. Today I'll be talking with Matt Oresco, a turtle biologist and ecologist who for the past 5 years has worked tirelessly for the creation of an eco-passage across the section of Highway 27 that crosses Lake Jackson that will protect the migrating turtles and other wildlife from being killed on the highway. And although Matt would probably be the last to say it, if there's anyone who could be called a hero to wildlife in our community, Matt certainly has earned that title. He has, at his own expense for the past 5 years, built and maintained a temporary fence along the section of Highway 27 to keep the turtles from crossing the highway, sometimes working 12 hours a day on the project, all out of his love and passion for keeping the turtles safe. He has committed enormous amounts of his time and resources into creating awareness and lobbying local government for the need for a permanent eco-passage, and has created the Lake Jackson Eco-Passage Alliance, a local nonprofit that supports his efforts. In my interview with Matt, I found his passion and enthusiasm for the turtles to be contagious. It was such a pleasure talking with him. I spoke with him at his home one Saturday afternoon. I'm here with Matt Oresco, and we're going to be talking today about the Lake Jackson Eco-Passage. So, Matt, maybe just start out by talking about, tell me about your background and how you got involved in all this.
Okay. I'm a biologist. I'm a turtle biologist. I'm also an ecologist. I have a PhD from Florida State University, which I just finished up in April of 2005. So I've worked on the PhD at Florida State since September of 1998. I also have a master's degree in zoology from Auburn University, and I'm originally from Connecticut, and that's where I developed my interest in turtles at a very young age, probably 5 or 6 years old. Growing up in central Connecticut, had my first experiences with turtles there, and that's where I really developed my love and care for turtles and all reptiles and amphibians and the outdoors in general.
So you grew up in a pretty rural area?
Yes, in central Connecticut. The land behind our house was about 1,000 acres of state land, so I got to run wild out there, bringing different critters home at a really young age. So.
To the chagrin of your mom and
yeah.
Me, probably.
Especially the snakes. So when I came to Tallahassee in 1998, I already had a background working with turtles. I worked with gopher tortoises for my master's degree, and I planned on working with turtles here in North Florida. And when I was looking for a place to live, I ended up just by accident finding a place right on McGinnis Arm of Lake Jackson. So I got to learn a little bit about Lake Jackson the first couple of years I was here. And then in 1999, the lake started to dry. The sinkhole drained due to several years of extensive drought. And that's when I really started with the project at Lake Jackson.
What exactly is the Lake Jackson Eco-Passage? Some people may not know anything about this.
Okay. It's, first of all, an eco-passage, that's just a general term for ecological passage. And it's a term that's synonymous with wildlife crossings or wildlife underpasses. But it's a whole system of barrier walls and underpasses that facilitate movement of animals under a highway rather than being killed as they travel over a highway. And the term eco-passage is actually a recent term that was developed by the Florida Department of Transportation to name a similar project that was done at the Paynes Prairie State Preserve just south of Gainesville. But it's something that really started in Europe before the United States, actually. And the U.S. really took the Europeans' lead on that. And as far as designing ways, structures, and other ways of keeping animals off highways and instead either facilitate their movement over or under highways. So that's what we're trying to accomplish at Lake Jackson. U.S. Highway 27 was formerly State Road 1, and it was built in the early 1920s. And instead of going around the lake at that time, they cut across a portion of the northwest arm of Lake Jackson. you know, back then it was a really rural road. There was no concern about the environmental effects of a road then. But in the early to mid 1960s, they rebuilt State Road 1, which was a, you know, a low two-lane road, and they built it up to a four-lane divided highway, and they dredged part of the lake on each side to build that up. They also brought in just tons of rock fill and concrete, and really built the shoreline and built it right across the arm of the lake over about a mile stretch of Lake Jackson. And it became so divided that the arm that was cut off to the west, which is about 60 or 70 acres, they named it a different lake now, Little Lake Jackson. We're really essentially, it's the same lake. It's just a very productive arm of the lake that was cut off. And the only connection now is a 12-foot diameter metal round corrugated culvert that they put in at the deepest part of the lake. That's my bird clock.
It sounds great.
And so that's sort of the background of the highway. And of course, as Leon County started to grow in the late 70s and early 80s, the traffic volumes have increased tremendously on US 27. In addition, it's become a major truck route from I-10 north into Alabama and Georgia. And currently the traffic rate is about 22,000 vehicles per day on US 27. So you have this combination of really high traffic rates with a road that bisects a key migration area, and you end up with the potential for really high road mortality. And so that's what brought me into this project, just observing that firsthand when the lake was beginning to dry in 2000.
So that's, I guess I was going to ask you to talk maybe a little bit more about the unique features of Lake Jackson, mm-hmm. that's causing some
yeah.
of this activity, turtle activity and migration.
And so Lake Jackson is a sinkhole lake, and karst is one of the primary geologic features in North Florida. We've got limestone under the soil. So we've got several lakes in North Florida that are sinkhole lakes where periodically during drought conditions, the sinkholes open and up to 90% of the lake bottom can completely dry. And it's not just Lake Jackson, but Lake Ammonia, Lake Miccosukee, Lake Lafayette are all big lakes in our area that are sinkhole lakes. And so it actually happens on a pretty regular schedule. On an average of about every 15 years or so, Lake Jackson has dried during drought conditions. It happened in the early 1900s, again in the 30s, the late 50s, the early 80s, and then again recently in 1999. And what that does, of course, is when you have a lake drying, you have thousands of animals, turtles, frogs, snakes, alligators, that are moving away from the drying part of the lake, attempting to find water in surrounding areas. And so these mass migration events occur. You know, normally it wouldn't be a problem in historic times. In fact, there's probably very little mortality. These animals are adapted for moving over long distances over land in search of water, and they can move, you know, 1 to 2 miles without any problem when the lakes would dry. But when you add these features like busy highways or, you know, intensive development, suddenly you have the potential for catastrophic mortality due to vehicle collisions. And that's what I noticed in February of 2000 when I just sort of discovered this problem by accident.
And I read on your website somewhere that this area is the highest turtle kill area in the world?
Yeah, that has been documented, yeah.
This is in the world?
Yeah. Most of the documentation has occurred in the United States and in North America. And, of course, one of the things about North Florida is it's one of the areas of the highest turtle diversity in the world, only rivaled by Southeast Asia. It's because of the many different habitat types that we have. Lots of different wetland types, lakes, rivers, and a lot of different upland habitats. So we've got an incredible diversity of turtles, and then habitats like our lakes can have a high abundance of turtles as well. So when you add roads into that mix, you can end up with the potential for, you know, high mortality rates, and that's exactly what's happened here. There's been other areas that have been intensively studied for wildlife mortality, and in particular turtles, throughout the U.S., but clearly this area is the highest that's been recorded. And again, it's primarily due to just the fluctuations in water level that occur both seasonally and, you know, dramatically during the drought conditions where you have these migration events.
Okay, so what have you been doing?
Okay, so
talk about about that. Yeah.
So it started in February of 2000. Actually, February 22nd of 2000, I was just taking a trip up North Monroe, up US 27, to go to the store, and I wasn't planning on studying, you know, turtle mortality on US 27 or anything else. And I was driving in the northbound lane, and all of a sudden I saw turtle carcasses dead, you know, along the shoulder, just north of the US 27 boat landing. And it was during a period when Lake Jackson was starting to dry. The main sinkhole had opened in September, and we still had very little rain, and so the lake was getting lower and lower, even the northwest part of the lake, which usually will keep water. And so I noticed these turtles, one after another after another. And I saw probably about 20 dead big turtles, Florida cooters, they were. And so as a turtle biologist, someone that's interested in turtle conservation, that really, you know, made me stop in my tracks, literally. So I pulled off the road and I walked the shoulder just to see what kind they were and, you know, to see if there were any live ones in the area. And I didn't find any live, but I found a bunch of fresh ones and then some that had been killed over the last week or so. And in total, I counted 90 dead turtles that were, you know, along the shoulder on the northbound side. And you know, I couldn't believe it. That's an incredibly high number of turtles. And not to mention, there was also just bone fragments of turtles. You can tell it was a graveyard, really, right on the side of the road. And it wasn't just turtles. There was a lot of remains of other animals as well. But turtles definitely were about 80% of what I saw. And it was primarily Florida cooters, yellow-bellied sliders, mud, and musk turtles. And so I decided, well, something obviously needed to be done. I could see what was going on. The turtles were trying to leave Lake Jackson and move toward Little Lake Jackson, which historically has never dried. And so that's sort of their watery retreat during drought conditions. And here we have this big highway right in between. And so I went home and tried to figure out exactly what could be done. The very next day I went out there again and I started picking up live turtles that were, you know, attempting to cross, as well as continuing to document the incredible numbers of roadkills that I found. And in the first 40 days, 343 turtles were found killed on that stretch of road. That's just about a third of a mile. But during that first 40 days, I also really tried to figure out how we could solve this problem, even just temporarily. And the first thing I thought of was using drift fences. For people that study reptiles and amphibians, we'll often completely encircle a pond or a wetland with a silt fence, the same material that's used on construction sites to control erosion. And it's a woven nylon black fabric. And it comes with pre-attached wooden stakes. And it's a fairly cheap material, and it comes in 100-foot rolls. So I thought if we could erect that along the highway and then use the existing 12-foot diameter culvert under the highway, maybe we can keep the animals off the road and then instead direct them through the culvert. And I didn't know if it would work out there, and I didn't know if I would even be able to get permission to do it. But I contacted Leon County, and they sort of directed me to the Florida Department of Transportation. We found out they have jurisdiction over the road. And they do have an ecological contingent. Their central office in Tallahassee, it's called the Environmental Management Office. So I contacted them, and they weren't real interested at first. They said, well, you know, this is a problem throughout Florida, animals being killed on highways, but we'll schedule a meeting to go out and look at it. So they brought someone from the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission and a couple of people from Florida DOT, and we walked around, and, you know, I showed them all the piles of turtle carcasses that were out there, and And so they at least acknowledged that, yeah, it is a problem, but they didn't know what they could do about it. They said it could take years of study and it would be very expensive. So I continued to go out there every day, and the numbers kept piling up, and I just kept calling them all the time. You know, we need to do something. It's only going to get worse as the lake continues to dry. And then I came up with this idea of the temporary fencing. And at first they said, no, we can't have a private citizen out on the right-of-way installing fencing. And I said, look, I'll buy the stuff myself. Just give me permission to go put it up. You know, I'll put it up. Don't worry about it. And finally they agreed, and they did agree to donate fencing as well. So the initial amount was 22 rolls, so that was about 2,200 feet of fencing. And I had them deliver it to me up there one day. I think it was right at the end of March, around March 30th of 2000. And it took me about 4 or 5 days. I rented a gas-powered trencher, and I installed this fencing. I had never really done any fencing work like that before. It was really hard work because the highway is built on a lot of concrete fill, and so it's really hard to dig trenches and put in, because you have to bury the bottom edge of the fencing so the turtles can't bury under it.
And you were doing this all by yourself?
Yeah. And literally, I mean, I could see the results while I was doing it, because the fencing that I had already put down, I could see turtles coming up and not going on the highway, and they were already being diverted. And then up ahead of me, I had to keep an eye out because I'd see them coming onto the highway in front of me. So I was really motivated to move as fast as possible. And so I was really happy when I got that initial fencing out there. And then I started going out and monitoring the fencing every day in order to document how many animals were coming up to the fence, what they were doing. And I realized right away that one culvert along that whole stretch was certainly not enough to provide rapid migration under the highway, because animals that come up 100, 200, 1,000 feet away from the culvert, they don't find the culvert. They wander back and forth. And so what I started doing was I got 6 big Rubbermaid plastic bins, and I'd fill those up with turtles, carry them across, take all the data, measurements, what species they were, move them to the other side, and come back.
Now you
do the same thing.
Now you're doing this every day.
Yeah, I did it. I did it every day.
And you're studying at FSU.
Yes.
So this is quite a lot of stuff you're doing.
The first spring and summer, it was just incredible. I did nothing else. I mean, 7 days a week. And during peak migration periods, I was out there from 9 in the morning until sunset, which is, after 9 o'clock at night when it, in the early summer. And this is during a time when the lake was in its final stages of drying. So there were days when there was 200 or 300 turtles along the fences. And you just have to imagine what the highway would have been like. In a way, I hid the problem from the public because I was picking all these turtles up behind the fencing I installed and moving them across unharmed. It would have just been incredible carnage out there. And by no means is the temporary fencing, a foolproof solution, because turtles can climb the fencing. Other animals, alligators, snakes, and frogs were still able to get right over the fencing. And of course, they can work their way around the end sometimes. I had problems with mowers. When they mow the right-of-way, the first time they mowed, I hadn't marked the fencing at all. And to my horror, they crashed into the fencing and didn't even know it, and ripped down like 200 or 300 feet of fencing that I had just put up. So I had to scramble to put that back up. There's been some vandalism, ATV damage, just you name it. Stormwater comes off the highway and it'll just flatten the fencing if you don't have it installed the right way. So it's been incredible maintenance of the array along with the monitoring.
This is a full-time job. You had two full-time jobs, full-time
exactly.
Student and this.
Yeah. And so as 2000 progressed, I added fencing on the other side, on the Little Lake Jackson side, because animals actually, as soon as the lake started to refill, when we got some of the tropical storm rains, even in September of 2000, animals started moving, the opposite way from west to east. And so I scrambled to get the fencing up on the other side. And then over the last few years, I've continued to add fencing. And now the temporary fence array extends about 3,500 to 4,000 feet on both sides of US 27. But still, we just have the one culvert, which is only about 500 feet from the north end of the array. So it's a long way to go for animals trying to find their way across, which means I need to be out there constantly monitoring the fencing.
So to this day, I mean, you're going out every day?
So that's when it started, and it became really my life up till the present. So it's been, 6 years now.
Let's take a break now, and afterwards we'll return to our interview with Matt Oresco.
My best friend is a turtle. Tukalamoka is her name. You may wonder why I call her something strange. It's 'cause I saw her walking one morning down my street, and that's the sound I heard her making with her feet. Toot toot, tukalamoga, toot toot, tukalamoga, toot toot, tukalamoga, that's my turtle's name. Toot toot, tukalamoga, toot toot, tukalamoga, toot toot, tukalamoga, that's my turtle's name. I hope she doesn't bore you, 'cause she walks so slow. But she must carry her house everywhere she goes. So if you see her walking one morning down your road, you'll know what to call her when you say hello. Hello! Toot toot, tukalamoga, toot toot, tukalamoga, toot toot, tukalamoga, that's my turtle's name. Toot toot, tukalamoga, toot toot, tukalamoga, toot toot, tukalamoga, that's my turtle's name.
Let's return now to our interview with Matt Oresco.
Well, this will probably sound like a kind of an insensitive question, but how do you, and some people will ask this probably, well, why should people pay so much attention to this issue? I mean, mm-hmm. wildlife gets killed every day on the road, turtles, armadillos, and what's the big deal with this?
Well, there's a few reasons why it's important. Just on a local level at Lake Jackson, Lake Jackson's a state aquatic preserve. The ecosystem of Lake Jackson functions with a high density of reptiles and amphibians, especially turtles. They're key components of the food web of the lake. I actually studied lake food webs for my dissertation research. This project was not my dissertation research, although I was able to use a lot of data from Lake Jackson. But when you start losing large numbers of these really important species in these lake systems, you are going to change the proper functioning of the lake ecosystem. For example, turtles are really important scavengers. When the lake goes through dry down periods and you have large fish kills, those fish would be lying there rotting for a long time. The turtles literally just clean them right out. I mean, they scavenge on them. And also, most of the turtles in the lake are herbivores, so they're eating plants. And specifically, they eat a lot of algae, filamentous algae. And they literally eat tons and tons of that stuff every year. I mean, some of these turtles, the Florida cooter, for example, the females can weigh 5 to 7 pounds. It's a really large turtle, 12 to 14 inches in length. And I try to compare them to people as if they're cows in the lake. That's how they function. They're grazers. So the structure of the plant community in the lake would be really different if you didn't have them out there. And so just in the food web and the ecological functioning of the lake, all these animals are really important. And during these catastrophic events during the dry down periods, you could lose literally thousands of turtles. So in the past, since February of 2000 to the present, to 2005, I've documented over 9,000 turtles that have attempted to cross US 27. And I've been able to save probably 90% of those because of the fencing. Just think about how different the lake would be if you lost those numbers of turtles. And it's not just during the lake refill and dry down events. They also move over land frequently, just, you know, normal movements seasonally, males moving over land looking for mates, females coming up to lay their eggs along the highway shoulder. And if you start losing large numbers of these individuals, especially the females that are coming up to lay eggs, you're going to have severe population declines over time. And in turn, you'll get changes in the functioning of the lake ecosystem. And if people that care about the lake as a sport fishery for bass fishing, turtles are really important to that. There's a lot of indirect effects that are going on, you know, that ways that the turtles help the food web that directly go to some of the sport fish and populations out in the lake. So everything is connected, and that's one of the important things. And they're just not random animals being killed on the highway. One of the other issues is traffic safety. If somebody doesn't care at all about wildlife mortality or rates of roadkill, even if there's thousands of them, you know, piled up on the sides of the highway, you really have to be concerned about traffic safety. And one of the main reasons that they built the Payne's Prairie Eco Passage was because of traffic safety. You're talking about large animals, alligators that can be, you know, up to 10 feet long that cross the highway, that can weigh 400 or 500 pounds, and even some of the large turtles, you know, some of the largest ones can weigh up to 30 pounds. And during mass migration events in particular, you could, if there was no fencing up there, if I had no fencing up there in 2000, 2001, during rush hour traffic, there literally could have been 100 animals, 100 large turtles trying to cross all at the same time in rush hour traffic. It's not a good mix, you know, large numbers of animals trying to cross highways in heavy traffic, you're going to have traffic accidents. I actually did witness one traffic accident myself out there during the migration in 2000. A young man saw a big Florida softshell in the road. He kind of pulled off the road to try to get it off the road. He didn't pull his car all the way off the road, and he got slammed in the back of the car by another vehicle, and then another car hit that vehicle. So there's a three-car collision because he, you know, tried to avoid a turtle that was in the road and get it off the road. But it's not just people stopping. I mean, people swerve. I've seen people, you know, hit their brakes. There's a lot of 18-wheelers out there. It's just a recipe for disaster, you know. And so just traffic safety alone, I mean, it's a documented problem. I'm sure, you know, we wouldn't want, you know, an occurrence to happen later when we knew it was a problem and you know, nothing was done about it. The first 2 years, all I was focused on was sort of the temporary system. It was during the dry down and the refill event. I was just focused daily on saving as many animals as I could out there. And I didn't really have time to think about, you know, permanent solutions and that kind of thing. But as 2001 kind of wound down, I started thinking about, you know, the future. I learned more about the Payne's Prairie Eco Passage, where they built a permanent system of culverts and walls. And I thought, wow, this could really work at Lake Jackson. We've got the same species. It's really the same problem. And they've addressed it down there. We should try to get DOT to address it here as well. And so I started learning a little bit about the process, what that would take. And by 2002, I had realized that DOT doesn't act alone. They don't just unilaterally decide transportation projects, what to fund, and that kind of thing. It all comes from the local level, the local transportation planning agency. It used to be called the Metropolitan Planning Agency. It's now called the Capital Regional Transportation Planning Agency. And it's a combination of the city and county commissioners. they prioritize transportation projects, and they sort of give a list of priority projects to Florida DOT to address. DOT doesn't come into a county and decide what they're going to do unless it's an interstate. So even though US 27 is a US highway, it's still the locals that decide what's going to be done, what's not going to be done. So I knew I had to work with the Board of County Commissioners. And so the first step was getting the board to recognize that there is a problem out there that needs to be addressed. And that was accomplished in September of 2002. When I went to the board, I explained the problem. I actually did a really short slide presentation at one of the board meetings, one of the regular board meetings, and they agended the item. And they voted to direct staff to search for ways to solve the problem and fund the project. So they weren't really, they didn't really address the project head on. They directed their staff to do that. And so staff tried to figure out what to do. I still was having conversations with Florida DOT. And what DOT decided to do in the fall of 2002 was to give money to study the problem. So I've been studying it pretty well biologically, but they wanted a more formal study done, and they called it a feasibility study. What would be the potential options, different obstacles to solving this problem permanently? And so they allocated $100,000 for that. They later increased that to $125,000 in total. And what had to be done was a consulting firm had to be hired, and that took just an incredibly long time to figure out how that needed to be done. This was just new to everybody in this area. Everybody knows how to plan road widening, new roads, and all of that. And this was just a different type of transportation project, but it was something that no one had ever really addressed before. So staff didn't really know how to address it. The commissioners didn't. And even DOT was a little unsure. Our main DOT office is in Chipley. We're in District 3, and they had never done anything like this before. So they were willing to provide money, but what they did was they left it up to the county to sort of manage the project, hire the consulting firm, prioritize the project. So really it lives and dies, you know, with the Capital Regional Transportation Planning Agency. It took until early 2004 to actually get this feasibility study underway. All of that time, it was just sort of bureaucracy getting to that point. And so finally in 2004, the study began. The feasibility study was completed late last year, so in December of 2004. And it was formally approved and accepted by the Capital Regional Transportation Planning Agency in early 2005. So all of this has just brought us to the very beginning of what is considered the transportation planning process. So now we're kind of in the system, is where we need to be. The main thing that came out of the feasibility study was what the preferred alternative is to solve the problem. And the preferred alternative that was approved by the city and county commissioners is essentially the same design that was done at the Paynes Prairie Eco Passage, which is to replace the existing culvert, which is worn out and 40 years old, with a large diameter box culvert, 12 foot minimum size, and then add three additional large underhighway culverts to the south of the existing culvert, about every 400 or 500 feet. And that the placement is really based on my data from where the key movement areas are along the highway. And then a barrier wall, which is, it's a concrete wall. They're in prefabricated sections. And so the height would be 4.5 to 5 feet tall. But it's set below the shoulder. So it's kind of carved out into the shoulder. So you know, when you're driving up 27, you wouldn't even see it. It's actually set below grade along where the highway was filled on both sides. And so the idea is that animals come up, they encounter this wall, they walk along it, they encounter the culvert, and then they move through the culvert. And the key for turtles is they have to be large enough so that they can see light on the other side, and there has to be a natural substrate. And these are all things that I've learned just from working with the existing culvert that's out there.
And the Payne's Prairie, now this is a proven technology. Basically.
Yeah, they actually did a one-year post-construction effectiveness study where they had cameras in the culverts. And their project down there was actually along almost a three-mile stretch of US 441. So our study area is only about half that. And so they found that the road mortality rates out there decreased to virtually nothing, you know, to compare to the pre-eco passage levels, which were incredibly high.
So, okay, so now you're at this stage. What's the construction time, or and where's the funding coming from, and that sort of thing?
Well, the first thing that needs to be done is what's called a project development and environment study. It's called a PD&E study, and every transportation project that's done requires a PD&E study. And so that's the next step, and that's going to be started just after the first of the year. Once that's accomplished, then we can finally move to the design phase, which is what I've been waiting for many, many years, which is actually the full-blown engineering design of the eco passage, the walls and the culverts. And hopefully we'll be at the design stage by next fall. Once the design stage is accomplished, then we can apply for federal money for the full construction. And so one of the keys is that none of the money is coming from local money. We are going to apply 100% for federal money. And our early indications from Federal Highway Administration is this would be a project that they would love to fund because it's a high-profile project. There's been national recognition of the project. It's not just a little local project. It's received statewide and national attention already through our website and through articles that I've written, major media articles from the Boston Globe to USA Today had a small piece about it. The National Humane Society has been a strong proponent of the project. So all of these things have made it a high-profile project, and so because of that, we're really confident that Federal Highways will fund the full construction of the project.
So time frame, you're thinking 2-3 years?
It's probably 2 years.
2 years.
Which would be really optimistic. It's just the bureaucracy you have to go through. The smallest thing causes 6 to 9 month delays with something like this. And for me, that's the most frustrating thing. Because in my mind, I can see exactly what needs to be done. But in the meantime, I still have to monitor these temporary, you know, silt fences. They require frequent replacement. The material only lasts about 18 months. In direct sunlight, it just wears out. So while I'm doing all this work, you know, lobbying and working with DOT and the Board of County Commissioners and staff to try to push this thing along, I still have to go out and monitor the fences and make sure that animals aren't being killed on the highway. So,
are you getting any help with that?
A couple of years ago, I formed the Lake Jackson Eco Passage Alliance. It's a 501c3 charitable organization. And so people have been, you know, donating money to help with the expense of the materials and the equipment and all of that. And DOT has even offered some help recently with that. It is a 12-month job, and I fully intend to, you know, keep at it until this thing gets built, one way or the other.
What can people do to help support your cause?
One of the things is to look at the website, and there's a whole list of things on it. The website is www.lakejacksonturtles.org, and it has all the information on the project, pictures of all the species and numbers of species I found out there. And then there's a whole list of things that people can do. If you'd like to make a small donation to the Eco Passage Alliance, it's a tax-deductible donation, and it helps, you know, with fencing replacement and monitoring the fencing and equipment and that kind of thing. Also for public outreach and education that we do to try to raise awareness for the Eco Passage. And also occasionally I have work days, so if you want to provide your email address, I can put you on the list, and you can come out and actually help replace some of the fencing and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of opportunity to do that. And we have bumper stickers that you can put on your car that a lot of people have now. It's become a good community effort behind this project. And to that, I'm really grateful that people have really gotten on board with it. And even some of the county commissioners, especially Commissioner Dan Winchester, who's the county commissioner for the Lake Jackson area, without his support, you know, we probably wouldn't be this far with the project.
Well, Matt Oresco, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us
today.
Thank
you. Thank you very much.
Well, that's our show for today. And I want to thank Matt Oresco for taking the time for talking with us today about the Lake Jackson Eco Passage. If you're interested in helping out with this worthwhile project, you can visit the website at www.lakejacksonturtles.org. Or you can email Matt Oresco at Oresco, that's A-R-E-S-C-O, at lakejacksonturtles.org. In case you're wondering about that cute little turtle song that you heard during the break, the song is called Tukulamoga the Turtle, and the artist's name is Roger Day. And you can find out more about his music at www.rogerday.com. And thanks to you for stopping by today. For Voices from the Red Hills, this is Barry Frazier.